I was thinking for this one, it'll be a lot of editing to do, but I thought it'd be cute if maybe we start with the outro of Mark thanking people for listening and telling them where to find our Instagram and Patreon, and then we'll end with the clap sync. That'll be the last thing people hear.
Oh my God.
Oh, that's funny.
Experimental podcasting here.
Time truly destroys all things, even podcasts.
I mean, if you wanted to go to the extreme, you can record the entire thing and then chop it up into bits and do the whole thing in reverse order.
You'll have to like keep guessing, like, what is this movie they're talking about? I'm very curious.
Yeah, right.
This whole episode's going to be created in post.
The problem is people would think we were talking about Memento for a while.
Yeah,
that's true. It would never get to the movie.
Yeah.
You know, actually, and I wonder if maybe Mike knows this, so this is another one of those director's names that I'm not totally sure what pronunciation to go with, like if it's Noé or Noah or No.
I'm pretty sure it's Noé.
Oh, good, because that's how I've been saying it for years.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We will stick with Gaspar Noé.
Noé.
It's been weeks since we had an episode where we talked a bunch about how to pronounce some director's name. I kind of thought that was in the past for us, but here we are.
I would prefer not to have to say the name of his life partner.
Oh my gosh.
Lucille Hadzihalzavilovich or something like that.
Oh, that was great.
Hello and welcome to Unwatchables, the film podcast to help you either prepare for or recover from your cinematic trauma. I am Mark Tatavio.
I'm Seth Troyer.
And today we are joined by film critic Mike D'Angelo to help us dissect one of the most polarizing art films of the 2000s, and perhaps the most controversial Cannes premiere ever, Gaspar Noé's 2002 reverse chronological revenge drama, Irreversible. Let's take it back to the start.
Ooh. Very nice.
Thank you. Thank you. So I don't want to waste any time getting to welcoming Mike D'Angelo, aka the man who viewed too much. That's referring to his personal blog that made him one of, if not the very first online film critics. Of course, his writing has appeared in many publications, including the AV Club, The Dissolve, Rest in Peace, Las Vegas Weekly, Nerve, Entertainment Weekly, Time Out New York, and Esquire, among others, I'm sure. He now has a thriving Patreon, of which I happen to be a member, and you can also find some of his reviews these days at Alternate Ending. Speaking for myself, there is no one whose opinion on a new movie I look forward to more than Mike D'Angelo's. So Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So yeah, I feel like the Patreon is kind of where you've been centered mostly these days. Is that something that you find to be preferable in ways to how things used to be?
In certain respects, I guess. It has advantages and disadvantages. I'm doing much better from a financial standpoint than I had imagined would be possible when I started it. It's not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things. But I assumed it would be almost no money. And that turned out there were more people who were interested in supporting me in that way than I anticipated, which is great. The main advantage is that, number one, I only have to write about films with one exception, which is there's a weekly poll, which you know about, in which patrons at a certain level can request films for me to watch and review. Other than that, though, I pretty much get to watch whatever I want. I don't get assigned a lot of films that I have no interest in, as I used to when I was writing for AV Club or Time Out New York or any number of other places. And I can also, maybe even more importantly from my standpoint, assume a certain degree of cinema literacy on the part of the average reader. So I don't spend a lot of time hashing through things that I might feel compelled to do in a professional review. I can make references and trust that people will either get them, or if they don't, will have the initiative to, you know, do a quick Google search and find out what I'm talking about. So I'm able to just kind of dive right into everything and do whatever I want stylistically. Now I don't have an editor telling me you're getting carried away here, so maybe sometimes I do get carried away. I don't know. But No, I really enjoy having, and I like having a community of people. I recognize a lot of the names. I mean, I think it's like 800 people now, so I don't know them all, but I know all the people who are in the $5 and above levels who are, you know, voting in the polls and submitting films for me to review and so forth. And a lot of them comment on a regular basis, and we have conversations. And so it's a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah, definitely from a reader's perspective, it's nice because, you know, as nice as a nice professional review is, there is something very, you know, personal besides the fact that we can comment, you know, and ask you questions and stuff like that. But there is a real kind of just getting straight to the point kind of intimacy of it. And yeah, I think you definitely get your money's worth. If anyone out there wants to check out Mike's Patreon, who is not so far, you can on different tiers, you know, put in movies that he might have to watch and review, whether he wants to or not.
I would like to point out that the cheapest one, if you just want to read the reviews, is $1 a month, which you will not even know you're spending, honestly. It'll just, like, who would notice $1 disappearing from their bank account? Maybe some people, I guess, but not many.
Nothing's a dollar anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Jeez.
Except for Mike's Patreon.
Yeah, and that's you get all the reviews for that. It's only if you want to get involved in voting in polls or requesting films that it would cost you any more than a dollar.
Mike, I'm curious, do you recognize Mark's name as the guy who spent weeks trying to get you to watch Freddy Got Fingered, which is kind of a towering film in the canon of this podcast?
That's a big deal.
I absolutely recognize Mark as one of the people whose names I know. I did not remember that Freddy Got Fingered was his film, and now I am giving him a very dirty look.
Yeah, it's a good thing the camera's off.
Yeah, can't see it. I want to apologize to all of the podcasts. Are there podcast listeners or viewers or both?
I guess both.
Mostly listeners, but
some people will watch.
Okay, so if there's anybody watching who's disappointed that they don't get to see what I look like, what happened is I was planning to be on camera, but I hadn't used my camera in a long time. And as soon as I turned it on and saw myself, I'm balder than I thought I was, and my apartment, there more of it is visible than I imagined. So I would have had to like put these guys on hold to clean shit up. And so this was a better solution.
Yeah, it's something that we discuss quite often on this podcast, that what you see visually can be very intense and a lot to take in. So respect.
Well, it's mostly that I would have gotten a different chair than this if I had known where my head was going to be in relation to the camera.
It's the chair's fault.
Yeah, exactly. That's my story.
We'll put a picture of you up, and we'll find the cleanest apartment to drop you into.
Perfect. With a crazy ass chair.
Yeah.
Put me on a stool.
If I could ask a question, I am very curious about, and I think a lot of people are when they come across you. You're an early adopter of like internet criticism and the marriage of film criticism and the internet. It seems like you kind of came up around that.
Oh yeah, I was one of the, I don't know, I might say that it's hard to know for sure because there were people on like bulletin boards before the internet was really a public thing, but as far as like ordinary people being on the internet, I'm probably one of the first 5 or 10 film critics, online film critics, that ever was, I think.
I worked hard on formulating that question without it making me like saying that you're old or something. It's not what I'm
trying to say. I am old. No, I mean, I've been doing this for, let me think. I started writing the reviews in 1995. So it's been 27 years. So that tells you people can do the math.
Yeah.
From there. I mean, I was youngish.
Must have been a trip to just see it like slowly merge and become a thing. Yeah, that it was like, now it's like such, it's at the forefront, obviously.
Well, I don't know if you know the story about how I was discovered, but I can tell you that if you like.
Please do.
Oh, I don't know your Spider-Man origin.
Yeah, no. So what happened was I started the site in 1995. It was originally strictly for friends of mine. I did not anticipate that the general public was going to read it. It was really just, I had been emailing friends of mine in other schools because I was attending NYU at the time. My thoughts on movies. And at some point I thought, you know what would be easier than cutting and pasting the same email they started giving us web space at NYU. So I thought, well, I'll just put it up here and I'll point you guys to the URL and then you can check it out at your leisure. So I started doing that in the summer of 95 and kept going through 96. The reviews gradually got a little longer. And then January of 97, my girlfriend at the time was a subscriber to Entertainment Weekly. And I went with her to a mall or somewhere to go shopping. She went in a store. I sat outside with her copy of the latest DW, Killing Time. And it had, that issue had the first, I think, article that was ever written about internet film critics. And suddenly I was reading my own name. Did not know that that was going to, they did not contact me about it in any way. I might not have seen it if I had not happened to be dating someone who subscribed. I mean, I'm sure probably somebody I know would have seen it at some point. But so, yeah, that was astonishing. And I ended up emailing the guy who wrote the article, Ty Burr, who I think is now the film critic for the Boston Globe, or he was for a while anyway, but was writing for EW then. And kind of mentioned in passing, hey, let me know if you need anybody to write freelance movie reviews. And he recommended me to the guy who did their video section, edited their video section, and they started using me as a freelancer in May of 97. And that is what I have done professionally ever since, somehow.
You have it.
Wow, yeah. That must have been a trip, too, for that to start out, I'm sure, just considered as a novelty. And then you do actually end up getting published in print publications. And now we've just kind of come full circle around where it's all online now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's such a sweet little moment, just seeing your name, just sitting there waiting, killing time.
Yeah, it was amazing. I would also like to point out that I was, it's not really full circle, but I was making considerably more money in 97 writing for print than I am now writing online. Even though in theory there has been inflation since then, it's less money even if you don't adjust for inflation.
Right. Yeah.
Just letting you know, internet. Come on.
Yep.
Be good to Mike.
Yeah, now everyone wants to do it for free now, so that market is flooded.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, then that would have been the path that landed you to start going to the Cannes Film Festival, right? I mean, how many years did you go to that?
Eventually, yeah. I didn't start going to Cannes until... Actually, it was the year that Irreversible was there. It was my first year.
Oh, wow.
Which was 2002, yeah.
Welcome.
Yes. Nice segue. So by then, I had been hired as the chief film critic for Time Out New York, which is a weekly magazine in New York. And so I started going to festivals... immediately in 2000, they started sending me to Toronto. They paid for me to go to TIFF. They would not pay for me to go to Cannes. So I eventually decided I wanted to go badly enough that I was willing to spend my own money. And always did. I never got paid. I got crowdfunded to go to Cannes on one or possibly two occasions, but I don't think I was ever professionally paid to go there. It was always my own money, and it's not cheap at all. It's, you know, like three grand.
Do you need like a publication to you know, get you credentials to go, or are you able to just do that on your own?
No, it's not a public festival, so you have to have accreditation of some kind. That's why I'm not going now.
I see.
Is because nobody has I used to cover it for the AV Club, and then Alex Dowd, who has now left the AV Club, but he took over as editor, and he decided he wanted to go himself. And the Dissolve shut down. Mm-hmm. And now, granted, I was not proactive about bugging people and saying, hey, who wants to send me to Cannes? But nobody has reached out to me and asked me to cover it for them, so I haven't been going.
Well, fingers crossed that hack gets to happen again at some point. I loved reading those dispatches.
Make Cannes Mike again.
Yeah, I miss going. The last time I went was in 2016. So it's been a while.
Well, that you definitely couldn't have had a more memorable first experience with what I've read about the premiere of Irreversible.
Is it always like this, fellas?
Yeah. Well, that film was late in the festival, so I kind of had a handle on what it was by that point. But I was still unprepared for that particular screening.
Yeah, I want to talk about Gaspar Noé to kind of go into this. For anybody listening, he's an Argentine filmmaker who works out of Paris mainly. And at the time Irreversible came out, I believe I Stand Alone was his only feature film.
That is correct.
Which I just watched for the first time kind of in preparation for this and did like. And it definitely leaves an impression. And I imagine it when you came to see Irreversible, was that basically, were you thinking about that? Or do you remember anything about your impression of him or I Stand Alone at that time?
Yeah, I had seen I Stand Alone at the 97 New York Film Festival, I think it was, and liked it. I thought it was, I didn't love everything about it. It was, I think I gave it a B. I was doing letter grades at the time. So it was mild. I was mildly impressed. Was more interested in it formally than content. He was doing this thing in that particular film, which he hasn't really repeated since, where he was using gunshot sounds as punctuation combined with these like really fast zooms that are very disorienting. So the film kept you in a constant state of like really strong unease, which he leans even further into in Irreversible. But that was the part that I really responded to, was just the innovation that he was doing with the sound and image, not so much the narrative, which is a little, it's just kind of upsetting in a way that, you know, it does the job, but not in a way that I found particularly either moving or insightful. It was just kind of, I wasn't offended by it, but I wasn't particularly affected by it either, I guess.
Yeah, it does seem like that is a point of contention throughout his filmography, is the grappling with craft versus plot. And whether one is earned or the other is earned, or
right,
which one am I to focus on? Which one do I walk away with? Which one helps makes the other suffer? Which one builds the other one up? As seems to be sort of the point where you either are frustrated by Gaspar or you're in.
Yeah, and I think he's first and foremost, I mean, besides a formalist, is a provocateur, I would say,
Sure.
Like, you know, kind of like a Von Trier or Michael Haneke. There's definitely differences, you know, between them, but they all, I think, you know, they have a new movie come to Cannes, everyone is kind of bracing for what they're going to throw at us next.
And bear in mind, for those who haven't seen I Stand Alone, it's not as bad as it makes it out that it's going to be, in my opinion, but there's a part late in I Stand Alone where a sign, for lack of a better text, comes up on screen that says, warning, you have, I think it's 15 seconds to leave the cinema.
Love it.
Yeah. So, I mean,
full grindhouse.
You have a sense of what he's about just from that, just from him saying, like, now's your last chance before the shit goes down.
Yeah, that definitely was, especially since nothing that really bad even happened after that either.
No, and that's the thing. And he doesn't give you that warning in Irreversible. And there are at least two scenes in Irreversible that could have used it. Three, really.
Yeah. So. And we'll dive into Irreversible here in just a second. But, you know, since then he has, you know, made a handful of movies, including Enter the Void, which was the follow-up, which kind of uses the camera as like a POV shot of the afterlife, basically. We have Love from 2015, which was a 3D film with unsimulated explicit sex in it. A few years after that was Climax. And he just had one last year, I believe, called Vortex. It does seem, just, you know, looking at your ratings and reviews and stuff, that Irreversible is kind of the outlier out of those. Is that accurate?
It's definitely the one that I like best, or it's the only one that I love. And I like I Stand Alone, as I said, and then everything he's made post Irreversible, I've been mixed about. Except Vortex, which I actively disliked. But that's mostly, disliking Vortex is largely me disliking Split Screen. So, and Vortex is a pretty much nonstop Split Screen film. And I find that even for short periods in De Palma films, I tend to sort of turn up my nose at it. So an entire movie of Split Screen. Mike Figgis used to do this with four different versions, like four different cameras. So it was a quadrant effect that I found truly unwatchable.
I want to take us into that Cannes theater. But first, just for anyone who hasn't seen the movie, Irreversible is, I mean, the chronological story is basically about a couple, Alex and Marcus, played by Monica Bellucci and Vincent Cassel, who are actually married in real life at the time of this movie. And if you follow it in order, it's a pretty straightforward revenge film where they go out to a party with a friend who's a former lover of Alex's, named Pierre, played by Albert Dupontel. And she is viciously sexually assaulted and attacked. And they find, or who they think is the attacker, basically, and follow him into this gay, nightmarish gay club called the Rectum, where a horrible, violent act happens. But really, doesn't play that way because we start with the final scene, which is the act of vengeance, and then work our way backwards to the idyllic beginning. And this does sound similar to Memento, although it's to very different ends, I think.
Or beginnings.
But even before we get into that, yeah, exactly. The Cannes, I was reading some articles about the Cannes premiere, which was held, I believe, at like 12:30 a.m., which is kind of an odd time, like a little later than usual. Like they kind of knew what was they were getting into with this.
They do that a lot. Love, which I also saw at Cannes, was also a midnight screening. So that's where they kind of like to put Caspar.
It's a midnight movie.
Yeah.
And all the articles about it are about hundreds of people walking out, and there were no awards given to it that year, from what I understand. Yeah, the jury was headed by David Lynch, but no, they went with The Pianist instead, which is quite a different direction.
Indeed. And was actually not one of my favorite films in that year's lineup either.
Yeah, no, I'm not really sure anyone looks back really at that movie as a classic at this point. But yeah, so I mean, is there anything you can share from the actual experience from inside there at Ground Zero?
Yeah, well, it's I mean, to say that hundreds of people walked out, I don't want to give people the wrong impression. It might have been thousands. that's an exaggeration. I actually looked up, I was curious about this. I looked up what the capacity is for. I'm pretty sure, I can't say this 100% positively, but I think it was in the Debussy Theater, which Cannes has two huge theaters. The Grand Théâtre Lumière is the one that you kind of think of. It's the biggest theater. It seats about 3,000, as I recall, and is where all of the red carpet premieres take place. I'm pretty sure they showed Irreversible at the Debussy, which is smaller, but that's a relative statement. It's still bigger than most theaters you've ever been in your life. Seats, I think, I remember I saw it was about 2,200. And I would roughly estimate that it was a completely full house. And I think half the audience was gone by the middle of the film. Like, so literally, I think like 1,100 people got up and left.
Wow.
That's so intense.
And it's not like it happened in waves. So what happened was the film started. Now, actually, you said it started with the act of violence. That's not actually true. There is a sort of prologue that actually involves the main character from I Stand Alone.
That's right.
Same actor playing pretty much, based on dialogue that he says, it seems to be the same character from I Stand Alone. It's not an important scene in any way, except it's kind of laying out the philosophical groundwork. And they're in an apartment above the Rectum. So then the camera kind of moves out and down and in. For those who haven't seen the film, the camera is doing truly insane things throughout on every possible axis through which a camera could move through space.
It's a floating ghost. It's insane.
Yeah.
And I think that's also the point where they say the big phrase that is at the center of the movie, right? The time kills all things.
Yes. He says that at the very beginning. So then we go into the Rectum, and that is an overpowering sequence that is hard to describe if you haven't seen it. And even if you've seen it on like a TV set, it's hard to describe what it's like to see it in a theater, and particularly in one of the largest movie theaters in the world, at which I am almost positive that Gaspar Noé went into the projection booth and told the projectionist, "I want you to crank the sound up to the highest possible level." And he's using in that sequence, he's using a particular kind of like sound wave that it was specifically designed to create, like, inspire nausea and panic in people. So, and it just goes on throughout the entire sequence. It's hard to describe, but it's like this.
It's like a siren.
Yeah, it sounds like a siren, only much more disturbing. And we're in near total darkness. You can just see little glimpses of what look like kind of semi-horrific things that are happening. Although I don't want to, like, kink shame anybody. So, you know, I'm sure if it was consensual, I'm fine with it. But it looks kind of terrifying in the dark.
It's violent.
Yeah, when you have no context for it. You know, and there were some people who consider the film homophobic, and I guess we can talk about that later if you want to. But the point is, this sequence, they're looking for the guy who assaulted Alex. They have been told that he's in this club. They're trying to find him. They're wandering from room to room through these dark, like, it's like they're in a cave almost. And this sequence goes on for a long time. Like, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 minutes, I want to say, before they actually find anyone or do anything. And that's when half of the people who walked out. Like, they didn't even make it beyond the rectum sequence.
Nobody even got their skull bashed in yet?
No, not even that. They just could not handle the fact that it was going on and on and on. And the thing is, this is the world premiere of the film. So nobody knows what the movie is. For all we know, it's going to go on like this for 2 hours.
And it'll never cut. No cuts, nothing. Just down in these tunnels.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, this is an aside, but it's kind of a fun aside. I was also at Cannes the year that Dogville premiered. This was the following year, actually. And nobody knew anything about Dogville in advance. The stills that they had released were not very clarifying. And so Dogville begins, and for those who haven't seen it, Dogville takes place. It's a 3-hour film. It takes place entirely on a chalk outline Brechtian set. So the film starts on that set. And I think it was like 30, 40 minutes in before I went, it's just going to be like this forever, isn't it? Like, I was sitting there waiting for it to, like, snap into a normal. I just didn't think he was going to do that for 3 hours.
Right.
And was shocked to discover that he was really going to. Oh, and sorry, this is another aside, but the similar situation with the Xavier Dolan film Mommy from 2015, which I also saw at Cannes, which is almost entirely in a Instagram 1-to-1 aspect ratio. And again, I was like, he's not going to do this for a 2.5, 3-hour movie. I forget how long it is. For a moment, we all thought, okay, he isn't, because like an hour and a half into the film, there's a big montage that's set to Oasis's, which Oasis song is it? I forget.
It's not Wonderwall, is it?
It is Wonderwall.
Oh, dear.
It is a Wonderwall montage. And one of the characters literally takes his hands and, like, pulls the screen to open up the frame from 1-to-1 into widescreen. And the whole Cannes audience applauded wildly. Like, finally!
At last.
And it stays widescreen until the montage ends, and then it goes back to square and stays square for the rest of the movie.
See, that's such a thing anymore, though, that I feel like I miss out on. Like, I love getting to know what I'm going in for with movies, but at the same time, the internet really, like, it, beyond spoilers, I'm not as worried about, like, spoiling a plot necessarily, but the, like, mm-hmm. you can hear a lot about, like those things that, like, are, like, so exciting to be in the theater and realize, like, it's just going to be this. Whoa, they're doing this.
The whole reason that I was willing to spend large sums of money to go to film festivals, because I've been mostly paying my own way to Toronto. I haven't gone to Toronto since 2019 because of the pandemic, but it's worth it to me. I want to be in the first audiences for these films, not because I have some need to be first, but for precisely that reason, because I want to be able to have a totally tabula rasa experience with no idea what to expect. And in fact, one year at Cannes, 2007, I didn't even know what the films were. I had a roommate of mine there. I stopped reading any kind of movie related news. So I didn't see the lineup when it was announced. I had a roommate take a Sharpie and black out all of the titles and directors' names. I had to spend the whole 2 weeks looking at the ground to make sure that I didn't see.
That's the best.
Because there were posters and shit everywhere. And so I went into every film at Cannes 2007 having no idea what I was about to see. I saw No Country for Old Men, did not know it was a Coen Brothers film until it was over.
Wow.
I guess that it was.
You are correct.
I can tell you the exact moment when I said, I think this is a Coen Brothers film. It's the moment when Chigurh is stalking, what's his name, in the hotel room, and he unscrews the light bulb, and you kind of see the shadow of his feet under the door. That was the scene where I was like, I think this might be a Coen Brothers movie. But I didn't know.
Yeah, Blood Simple.
Yep. Oh, that's nuts. Yeah. I can only imagine that must have been great. I'm sure it was a lot of work, probably not easy to do that every year.
The only reason I've never done it again is because it was such a pain in the ass. I couldn't even have conversations with people. Like, I had to walk around with like headphones on all the time, and it was really, you had to live in a little bubble. And also for like several months before the festival, I had to kind of tune out of all of my normal. You know, I was on a very active cinema chat group, and I had to kind of remove myself from it for a few months so that I wouldn't see discussion and so forth. So that's the only reason. But in theory, if I could somehow wipe out my memory so that I could go into everything cold, I would love to do that. It's my ideal.
And I like, too, you talking about the imagining that they cranked up the sound system on this particular thing, this particular premiere, too, because this was actually the first movie that the three of us sat and watched together to talk about on the podcast. And
just three boys on a couch watching Universal.
Yeah. Not really. Wasn't it? Passing around the old bowl of popcorn. The sound was like, I had to keep they're going to kick me out of this apartment if I don't have this sound under control.
Because Mark's got all these old ladies in his apartment.
This just low frequency, like hum and throbbing like the whole time. And I was imagining that theater probably had the walls just rattling.
Oh, it was. I didn't ever think of leaving. I was kind of excited by it because it was just so intense.
Sure.
But it was hard to sit through. And I got to say, just as a general comment on Irreversible, it's a film I've seen, I think, four times now, but I have to steel myself every time, including the most recent time. I finally rewatched it maybe 2 years ago. And it was really just like, okay, I guess I'm doing this.
Here we go.
I have the same feeling about Audition, which is a film that I love even more, but have a hard time actually sitting through. Oh, anyway, that was the first wave, was the rectum wave. And then we lost, you know, so probably 500-600 people right there. So by the way, you're trying to like watch the film over like multiple people getting up and walking out in front of you, as will happen. And then the people who remained were kind of in it for the long haul until the rape scene. And then another 500-600 people, which I understand, could not take that. When that also just went on and on and on. And they were just like, okay, that's enough. And I respect that decision. It's not a decision that I made, but I respect it.
Yeah, and I bet that was a moment that was replicated in most theaters that showed it probably at that point.
I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, and ironically, that's when the camera finally sits down and just gives you a static shot the one time you don't want to be staring straight ahead.
Exactly. Which is very intentional.
Yes, extremely, extremely. And I mean, it certainly works. Like, there's nothing to distance you from that. And but it is funny to think people who've just heard about this movie generally hear about the rape scene and probably assume that's when most people storm out. But I think this has kind of the Blair Witch effect, where people would just go in and actually get dizzy or just can't handle something that's visually incoherent.
And yeah, the sound is disturbing. I can't help but I also can't help but picture Gaspareau entering the projector room, and he looks kind of threatening. Like, he's a big, like, bald guy with a mustache with like a thick accent, and he's like, turn this shit up.
He's in the rectum scene. I don't know if you saw him.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, I heard that he is. Yeah. Yeah.
It's his favorite spot.
And I think that was maybe an olive branch to show that he wasn't trying to other these people too much, which is arguable.
Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, when do we get into what with this stuff is like the question. Yeah. But we can keep going with how the plot all works, I guess.
That's basically all you need to know as far as discussing it, because you get to the midway point of the movie and all of a sudden it's like, I mean, imagine you walked into the theater late and it's such a completely different experience stylistically, like the way the movie calms down when it gets to that second half, which, I mean, I find to be extremely effective because it's so prolonged both times, the first half and the second half. It really makes you feel that. And I mean, if nothing else, this movie is a visceral experience, whatever you think of the ideas going on or whether it's maybe a little kind of dorm room philosophical, that stuff works for me because he sees it through to the end or to the beginning, you could say.
No, I agree. But the thing is, I find it fascinating and upsetting in a weird way that there is, I don't know if you guys are aware that there is, he created a version of this that's in chronological order.
Yes.
Yeah. Which I forget what it's called. Irreversible, the something.
I think
version.
It's the straight cut or something. I heard it's
that would have been a poor choice. I hope it's not.
Could be. But have you seen it?
I have not. And the thing is, I feel like if I were to watch this film in chronological order, I think I would find it offensive and unaffecting and awful. I think it would be a terrible film if it were not told back to front.
Yeah, there's a great interview with him on YouTube, like talking about it, and it just it feels like Spinal Tap or something, like that it's like this revolutionary idea of now taking his revolutionary idea and making it normal or something.
Yeah, no, that's it. It's just so, it's a terrible idea, and I don't know why he thinks, I mean, maybe it's just a marketing ploy on his part, because he's not above that sort of thing at all.
Seth was right. It is actually called Irreversible Straight Cut.
Wow.
So yeah, not the best.
Still being a controversial boy, that Gasper.
Yeah, I feel like that must have been done intentionally, and I don't approve.
Yeah.
Everything about that was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. But,
I mean, double down. You've got a terrible idea. Give it a terrible name.
I keep getting in there. Release it again. You had a controversial film. Release it again.
I mean, it was basically, it would be like doing the same thing with a movie like Memento, which, again, would have, I think, should come up at some point during this conversation, because that's also a backwards movie. And, it's serving a very distinct purpose. Although, I do think it's interesting the differences between the two, because in Memento, we're, the whole purpose of it is to always start us off in each scene with a blank slate in a way to reflect where the character is coming from and put us in their shoes. Whereas in this movie, we start out in the first scene with the characters having all the information and knowing what's going on, and we're totally in the dark. And then as it goes on, it's like we gain information as they lose it. And it kind of gives this God's eye view of something that the characters aren't aware of, which is like similar, but philosophically, I think kind of the effect that he's going for.
The film that this, now there's also maybe Harold Pinter's Betrayal would be applicable here. I have embarrassingly never seen Betrayal in any form, but the film that Irreversible is actually most like in terms of what it's doing is it might be Jane Campion's first feature, I think it is, which is called Two Friends. She made in the mid-80s, I think 86. And Two Friends is just the story of a friendship that dies, basically. But it's told backwards. So it starts off at the point where they aren't talking to each other anymore, and then it moves back to the point where they meet. And so it's basically just, it's a sad story that chooses to go from misery to bliss. And that's exactly what Irreversible is doing. And the, obviously the title is a way of underlining that that's not possible in real world. You can't go in that direction. It's not how time works. But the magic of the movies is that you can, for the space of an hour and a half, experience it in this way in which, you go back gradually. It's kind of like moving from death to birth in a way.
Definitely. And that stylistic difference too is, that first part really does look like you're literally in the bowels of hell. And
right.
By the time we get to the end and that, final shot where you just have these vivid greens in a lawn and children going through a sprinkler and, it's spinning around, that I think at least viscerally, it works, whether or not you're along for, right. for the for it conceptually.
Yeah. I did think it was interesting, and Wiki simplifies everything. And so it's just funny to see like this vague sentence that's on here. No way. First found financing by like convincing them that like it would be a more capital idea to now make it in reverse because of Memento, like, which is interesting. Like that this is like, man, I just can't get my like normal intense crime movie made. And the only way I can do it is flipping it in reverse and making it all experimental.
He sold him on it being like the future of cinema. Like they're going to start doing, you know, the Lion King remake's going to be in, in reverse or something.
This is what the kids are into.
The thing is, I fundamentally do not believe that he would ever have sat down and wrote that. There's no reason to tell the story forward. It's not interesting in any way if you go in chronological order. It becomes both offensive and banal.
He doesn't seem like that guy either, at least judging by the films that I've seen it is. Like, he seems very like interested in those kind of experiments. He's very like heady, psychedelic, especially like Enter the Void is so like over the top psychedelic, like going into the spiritual. So it's not surprising that this guy would want to first and foremost fuck with time and fuck with how the audience processes time in an almost like science fiction kind of way, which I think it is something that kind of like struck me with this viewing of it, that it almost feels like literally time out of joint, like Slaughterhouse 5 or something, like that kind of like event is occurring before my very eyes, which is very exciting.
I will say the one thing is, I think, again, I have not watched it in chronological order, but from my memory of the way the camera moves, I feel like if you were to watch it in chronological order, what happens is the rape occurs and that sets the camera on a fucking insane tailspin for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. For
from that point forward, which does make sense. And we're seeing it backwards. So it starts off crazy and then settles down instead. But clearly that violation is what causes. It was just reminding me because you said time out of joint, and it kind of physically goes out of joint in terms of the formal approach as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you're right that going in the direction it goes in is what makes it interesting. And also this last time watching it, it was really struck me about how, you know, there is an obvious philosophical overarching thing going here, but this is taking the form of a revenge movie. You know, again, I'm sure the straight cut is just a very clear, you know, hits all the beats, the regular structure that you expect, where you have the idyllic beginning, you have this horrific crime that takes place. And a lot of revenge movies will do that, where the kind of thrill that you get out of the revenge is in direct proportion to like how awful the thing is you have to sit through, that vengeance is being taken for. So looking at this as a deconstruction specifically of like revenge films, I think is really productive too, because you have, you know, the thing, of course, with revenge movies, a lot of them just purport to be actually about, you know, the toll that revenge takes on you and how you can't really ever get anything back. And it's kind of like that thing about how you can't make an anti-war movie without making war seem exciting on some level. And the revenge movies kind of generally do that too, where they kind of pay lip service to it being a lesson against revenge, but, you know, we all really know why we're there. And just scene by scene in this movie, the way that it gives us the so-called catharsis right up front, except it's not cathartic because we don't know what's going on. We just see it as being nauseating. And once things do start to come into focus, we've already seen it. So there's no satisfaction to be taken putting it in that backwards order. And I don't know, just scene by scene, the dissonance that produced in me, I really felt to be a trip too. Like, this is maybe the actually most experiential anti-revenge movie, even though I don't really think that's the ultimate message, but it does a really great job of taking the juice out of what we would normally get, because you're too far away from the revenge to get satisfaction from it anymore.
Right. And also the thing that, again, this is another reason not to do it forward, is when you're doing it the way that it's actually structured, we don't know. You would have to see the film twice or have a very good memory to notice that the rapist is present during the fire extinguisher, the horror scene. He kills the wrong person, but the person he was looking for is there.
Yes.
Standing right nearby. We have no way of knowing that yet because we haven't seen the rape take place. You would have to usually see the film again or be told by somebody. If you watched it forward, you would know, and the irony would be too, I don't know if cute is the right word, but it would be too in your face.
Again, getting to the second part of this movie, which I think is almost the real test here. And I think when we were watching this in person, this is kind of what it came up with this, because it kind of, it gives you all of this stuff that almost makes you numb. It's so extreme. And it just kind of leaves that to sit in your stomach for the rest of the movie as it gets, you know, calmer. And I guess the question is it possible to enjoy these kind of playful, you know, dialogue scenes that happen afterwards? Like, is it possible for him actually to ease you back into that? And I mean, to me, the effect is like slowly waking up from a nightmare till we literally have them in bed, like waking up from a dream in the couple's last or first scene together. And I think, I mean, that was where you ran into some resistance there, Seth, right?
Yeah, I think before we let Seth answer this question, I want to pose the question to Mike first. So you said maybe 500 or 600 people walked out during the Odyssey into the rectum, and then maybe another 500 or 600 during the rape scene. How many people walked out during the scene of the couple just sort of enjoying a blissful afternoon, teasing each other in bed? Because we lost an entire third of our audience.
Really?
All right.
No, I do not think anybody walked out of that part.
All right. It's just you, Seth.
I'm just really afraid of tits. I'm just terrified of tits. I mean, what I experienced in my viewing experience this time was very much, the first time I had seen it, I will admit, I kind of scrubbed through the big scene, the rape scene. It was very difficult, and I couldn't resist to like give myself the levity of like skipping ahead a little bit, which is the danger, right? You know, or the situation when you have this power, when you're watching something in your own home and something that has crawled out of your TV screen is like making you feel nauseous. So this time I really was like, I'm going to watch this scene and like try and get to the bottom of it and feel it. And I really do think it's, as much as it is just so horrific, it is the way to do this scene, I think. And it all works so well, the way that it stands out in the center of the film, even from a craftsman's perspective of the cameras spinning around the room constantly. But here it is respectfully, or whatever word you want to use, is like stationary. Here we are, and there's no place to run, and I'm faced with this experience that is, after a while, it takes me out of the movie because I'm thinking so much. I think the audience is thinking about like the real world and everything outside of this movie. This happens all the time, and you're being like reminded of all this horrible shit that you try and forget in the world, and like what it would be like to be in this situation too. And then the movie goes on, and I just found it. That was like the part that was like not disturbing, but it was just hard for me to like then sit through a movie now after I've like gone through such an experience. I don't know. My mind was just too preoccupied on the experience, and I could not focus on, now we're developing the characters on like a train ride and things like that. Not necessarily a criticism. It was just like, That was the aspect of it that like I kind of was like, I'm not leaving necessarily, but I guess I would count myself as like a walkout, I suppose, at this point.
So that's very interesting. I have a couple thoughts on that. So first of all, I agree with you entirely about the rape scene itself, which I have always defended. And I was very confident about it 20 years ago. I was kind of obnoxious about it, actually. I understand the other point of view better today than I did then. And I am cognizant of the fact that, for example, that scene has been kind of lifted out and gets like traded around in shitty parts of the web, and people are out there probably jerking off to it. And that's all awful, obviously. But my feeling both then and now is, almost all movies, because they're not trying actively to alienate viewers, they almost all aestheticize rape in some way to make it much less awful than I imagine, you know, I have no personal experience, but I imagine that it is. And I felt like this was the first rape scene that I had ever seen where I was like, oh, I fully understand what a truly nightmarish, life potentially destroying experience this could be for someone. Even before, now it also turns into like a horrible physical assault where she's getting her head slammed repeatedly into the ground. But even before that, even if that part of it never happened, just the actual rape itself and the fact that it goes on and on like that, as they presumably often do, he doesn't let us off the hook in any way. And almost everyone else does. And in some weird way, I appreciated that I was not being let off the hook for once. The closest maybe that I could remember previously was the rape scene at the end of The Accused, which Jodie Foster won the Oscar for. The first Oscar, I guess. But even that, I was not happy with the fact that they held that scene until the very end of the movie, as if we were being sort of rewarded at the end with it for hanging in there. I haven't seen that film since 1988, so I don't, you know, maybe if I saw it again, I would feel differently. But then I find it very interesting. I can kind of understand how, having endured that, you would find it hard to just, you know, say like, we're going to pretend that that didn't just happen, because in the world of the film, it didn't just happen. It's something that's going to happen later. So it works for me anyway, I think, because now, I haven't seen the film in a couple years, but my memory is we go from the rape scene backwards to the train scene. Is that correct?
Yes.
There's a party scene in between where they kind of get into a fight and she leaves, but I don't think that's as significant as the subway scene.
The train sequence, that particular, now very apparently I have read, I don't know whether to believe this or not, I have read that they improvised all of that dialogue and that it was different every time, that they shot multiple takes and that all of the takes were, in terms of what they were discussing, were different, which I find hard to believe, because the take that's actually in the film is very relevant to what the film is about. It's a lot of basically Alex telling Pierre that his problem as a lover when the two of them had been together was that he was overly concerned about her feelings and her welfare and not concerned enough about what he wanted, which is horrifying relative to what we have just seen happen, that's about to happen to her, but also feeds into the decisions that Pierre is going to make and why it ultimately is Pierre rather than Marcus who picks up a fire extinguisher and pummels somebody into oblivion.
Right.
So the fact that that conversation feeds into the beginning / end of the film, it works for me as a transition, so that I didn't feel like we were just instantaneously going from horror into like, I mean, their tone is lighthearted, but the substance of the conversation relative to the film is not. Does that make sense?
Right. And I felt that connection. Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I shouldn't say that it's like totally divorced from the movie or something. It is. It's just, my mind is just so shocked at that point. It's just, right. Yeah, I just felt like it was like difficult to catch up with the, I don't know. I was just like hearing my own thoughts at that point was louder than hearing the voices of the characters or something. It was just a particular experience. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, allegedly, according to Noé, there was only a 5-page shooting script for this movie and that the dialogue was improvised.
Wow. Huh.
And, you know, I kind of believe it, because I think maybe the difference between this and a lot of his later movies is that he didn't tend to work with actors who were this good again, and that it relied, that his, you know, his writing, there's a lot of dumb stuff in his movies after this, and that maybe by kind of outsourcing that to these really good, you know, performances is what helps push this over the line, basically.
Oh, yeah, because I think all three of them are terrific.
Yes.
I'm a little sad that I've seen Albert Dupontel in very little since, in the 20 years since this movie, which makes me sad because I think he's fantastic. Cassel and Bellucci I have seen plenty of times, but he's also a director, I believe.
So right.
He's making films of his own. I haven't seen any of them to date, but I do not think this film would have worked if he had just found a bunch of people on the street that he thought looked interesting and just tried to get them to do it. It would... I think that would have been a disaster.
Wasn't that kind of what your one of your? I remember reading what you wrote about love, also from Cannes, which is basically like he had to kind of settle for actors who were willing to do the sex scenes,
right,
as opposed to maybe somebody who was, you know, as accomplished as, you know, Vincent Cassell or Monica Bellucci.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I haven't seen Love since that festival, but yeah, that's my memory, is feeling like people were flailing whenever they weren't boning.
Right.
Yes. Gaspar is a horny boy, as many directors are, but he's particularly a horny boy. Which I can say that I did enjoy the third act the first time I saw it quite a bit. The third act is very beautiful, and it still has that ghostly movement, but it's finally like feeling like it's going more in a steady, like almost slow motion sometimes. We're lulled and rocked after being shaken and kicked around with the first and second act of the movie.
Well, also at the very end, he starts you off with just that noise, and he finishes off with fucking Beethoven, like one of Beethoven's loveliest pieces. Mm. So it's hard not to be moved by that. Really,
it's gone full high art, absolutely. And there is something interesting, and I'm curious what you guys think of like what this part of the movie is doing in context of the whole project of it being in reverse and taking the center, which I do think is Alex's the center and what happens to Alex and everything. There is something, again, it was experiencing it was a different story for me, but at least like in my own thoughts and on paper, there is something interesting about the idea of going the other way after a rape scene, where we are now healing this character in a way.
Right.
Yeah. And we are like Superman in the first Superman movie, reversing the earth and like everything we would love to do for someone in that situation. There is something kind of beautiful about that. And also like humanizing, like if we can just like go the other way where they are like slowly, like as the third act continues, it's not that we've forgotten the rape scene or anything, but we are slowly being reminded, you know, again, that like this, there's more, there's much to this character. There's more to this person. And of course that's true, but that can happen sometimes in like victim narratives. And that can be a struggle, of course, for people who have been through like difficult situations where they like are defined by those situations or feel like they have been defined, where there's more to them, obviously. So I found that compelling about it.
I think the I don't know, I was about to say genius of the film. I don't know if I would go that far, but I think the reason it is a great film is that it is precisely that it is simultaneously horrifying and weirdly optimistic because of the structure. Now he makes a point at the very end of like he gives you that beautiful final shot, and then he moves into a strobe, and then he reminds us time is going to destroy everything. So he still ends on a down note, technically speaking, but it's still operating in both of those spheres at once, and that's the only reason that it works, which is why you would not want to put it in the other direction.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think that's my only, I mean, real criticism of the film is a little, and it's really just a minor irritation where he does have to kind of state that theme. We get time destroys all things, you know, at the beginning and at the end. There's a couple little conversations about how, you know, the future is already written and we just have premonitory dreams about it. There's that poster of the 2001 A Space Odyssey 2, the ultimate trip, that it keeps like going past.
We get it, honey. Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. we could have let that speak to itself, but it's not as bad as like I just watched Enter the Void for the first time too. And man, they bring up like the Tibetan Book of the Dead right away. And then someone shows up to explain exactly how it works and right seconds before it actually happens. And then even throughout the flashback scenes and everything, it keeps coming up again and again. And we're like, we got it. So compared to that, you know, I could roll with this a little bit more.
Yeah. No, I have friends who are very angry about the 2001 poster. or at least they were at the time when we had discussions about this 20 years ago. There were people who that set them off for some reason. It's just like, you pretentious fucker.
Right.
Like, we get it.
It ties the room together.
It doesn't bother me particularly. I mean, my my major reservations about the film are basically the guy does have a sort of adolescent mindset to some extent that crops up in everything he's ever made. And I just have to kind of make my peace with it, I guess. And so I don't ultimately, it's not for me to say because I'm straight, but I don't, my sense would never have been that the film is actively homophobic, that although if you take homophobic literally, maybe it kind of is. Maybe there is some fear there as opposed to hatred. But yeah, just the particular conception of the rectum and just the fact that it's even called the rectum is just, you know, there's part of that just, it just seems a bit juvenile to me, I guess, and I have to kind of roll my eyes and move on.
Yeah, and I know that Noé's, his explanation or his defense basically is that he just wanted some place that was going to be devoid of women. Like he wanted it to be just full of testosterone. And again, that's kind of a weird solution for that, especially since, you know, we're seeing this rapist who's first attacking another girl before he assaults Monica Bellucci's character. Right. And then it turns out he's a guy who hangs out in the gay club. And that's where we, you know, that's our substitute for hell, basically, which... Yeah. Yeah, like I don't take too personally or anything. It because I think adolescent is maybe a good way to put it. That was just the simplest way he could think of putting that across. And you kind of see that across a couple different of his movies. He tends to just have characters who are homophobic in a way that's not really like, I don't know, that's just a minor detail about them as opposed to anything important. There's lots of like hurling slurs around and just generally kind of being accused or afraid of being called a fag or something. And who knows where that comes from.
I like Mike calling it like literally homophobic because of the fear inducing element, I think is good. But I just want to go on the record as the token straight guy on the podcast and say that Mark and Seth and I do karaoke on Wednesdays at the gay bar in our neighborhood. And if we ever get the opportunity to do karaoke at a place like this, we're absolutely doing it.
At the Rectum?
I'm not scared. Yeah.
I would love to go to the Rectum's trivia and karaoke night.
Definitely.
I don't think I don't want to have to compete with that siren though. That doesn't seem like
exactly.
That does sound difficult. That's right. He's also yelling through the streets. Where's the rectum? We have to find the rectum. Go to the rectum, which is also really hilarious.
Okay, now that's funny.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Tapeworm, rectum, it's all pretty silly. But yeah, I don't know. A lot of that smacks of like, and we kind of talked about it on the John Waters episode of like, it seems like if it's not quote unquote good representation of gays, it's always going to like make somebody pissed if it's not just like a nice gay character that's your friend or something, which is, again, a little weak for me.
Yeah, that's Noé for you. Throw it all out there. He probably saw a great setting and went with it. But so usually we like to end these conversations by each of us sticking with the theme of the podcast, saying whether we would unwatch the movie if we could. Although it's usually pretty clear by the time we get to this point.
Yeah.
Do you think this is the hardest like film you consider great to actually watch and sit through?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is the one that I am most scared of re-experiencing and that I most have to steel myself for. Like I said, the other contender would be Audition, just because the violent scenes in Audition are uniquely, at least I don't see a lot of like really extreme gore, which I don't enjoy. So I don't often see things where there's that much on-screen suffering, which is the thing that I have trouble with. You can do anything to a corpse that you want to, and it won't bother me in the slightest. It's only when people are like screaming in agony that I have a really hard time. And there's a lot of screaming in agony in both Irreversible and Audition. In Irreversible, a lot of it's being muffled by the rapist, but that only makes it worse, really. So yeah, I think this is the hardest one. I remember the most recent time that I rewatched it, I had to kind of gear myself up to it over a period of days where I was like, I know this is coming up in my, because I have kind of a little thing that I go through in terms of what I see. So I knew it was coming and I had to kind of like prepare myself and find the right night where it was like, okay, I think I'm ready now. So it's a film that I love, but it's also a film that I fear in some ways. But I would not unwatch it.
All right, Seth, where do you finally land as the after that harrowing experience on my couch?
It was good to share the couch with you, boy. We'll pick something lighter next time. I don't know. Not likely for this podcast, though. I would say I would not unwatch this movie. I'm starting in reverse order. Usually you say that at the end, but I'm starting with that. Because I do think it's all very effective, and I do think a lot of the difficulty here is earned for the most part. I could definitely understand why virtually 50% of the population, if not more, would get up and leave the room, and it's fine. Like, that's a big part of this podcast is like, yeah, movies are great, but it's you don't gotta stay. If it's really bothering you all that much, you can live your life without it.
I should say, by the way, that was my experience at Cannes when it was the world premiere and nobody knew what was coming. I watched the film again at Toronto later that year, and there were still some walkouts, but many, many fewer. By then, people kind of knew what they were in for. And the people who did not want to go near a film like that just didn't show up.
Oh, totally. I do really enjoy the first part of the movie. I think the rectum scene is just so hellish and such a visual, crazy feast that I don't want to necessarily eat. And I love, I wish I knew more. This is something I don't know if you know more about, Mike, but is what the hell, how does the camera work like that?
They had to, they invented a rig, is what I understand. I don't know. I don't have a good technical background in terms of how that sort of thing works. So, but I do know that there was some kind of gyroscopic rig that they created specifically to execute all of those moves so that they could go along every possible axis.
And I believe Noé operated it himself too.
Oh, that's amazing.
Which he claims that he used cocaine when they were filming the rectum scenes.
It feels like he's inside a camera-like plane that he's piloting.
Yeah.
I don't know when or if I'll watch it again.
I'm free tonight, Seth, if you want to come over.
Oh, yeah. Come on down, Mike. Four boys on the couch watching Irreversible.
For me, this is his only film I really like get an emotional connection from. And it maybe, I don't know, maybe it's the one time, there's a few of his movies I still haven't seen, but it seems to me like this may be the one time where just everything comes together, where his willingness or obsession with provoking and shocking actually works for the film instead of being a distraction. And this really relies a lot on those three main actors who I think are terrific. So I think it's probably his masterpiece. I'll be happy if he makes another movie that's that impactful again, but I don't know. I'm not really holding my breath for it. So I definitely wouldn't unwatch this. And I was surprised at how much I actually was able to kind of recover in the final part to actually find it powerful. And that's, you know, I think the missing element with a lot of his movies.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned that. I feel the same way about this, that it's, I do like, as I said, I Stand Alone, but I think this is like heads and shoulders above everything else he's ever done. The one time that it sort of all came together, it just occurred to me just now, that's also true of Audition.
Mm.
And I've seen a lot of Takashi Miike films. I've seen like 25. And there are others that I like mildly, but there's Audition, and then everything else is well below that. So somehow that one just all worked in a way that he's never been able to duplicate.
Yeah, maybe just a provocative clock is sometimes right twice a day.
Yeah, good
point. And they just stumble upon it sometimes. All right, well, I really want to thank Mike for doing this with us. This was really a blast and kind of a dream come true just because, you know, get a chance to talk at length after reading your work all these years.
No, that's my pleasure.
But I do want to pick your brain again, just real quick, right? At the time of this recording, it's September in 2022. Off the top of your head, do you have like a favorite film of the year so far, or a couple maybe that are standing out?
I just saw my favorite film so far this year, which is Decision to Leave, the Park Chan-wook film that was at Cannes earlier this year. It's one of only three films from Cannes that I've been able to see so far. I also saw Triangle of Sadness like hours ago and was not as keen on that one. And then had mixed feelings about Crimes of the Future. So those are the only three from Cannes. I haven't seen most of this year's, what will presumably be considered this year's major films yet. But Decision to Leave, I have not been a big... I've liked some of Park Chan-wook's films, but I have not... This is the first one that I've really kind of loved. Caught me by surprise a little bit. So that I highly recommend. I think that's coming out in theaters next month, if I remember correctly. And then what else? Do I have anything else from this year? I can't even remember. I'm looking at my top 10 list now. Oh, this was also at Cannes, although it was not in competition. The new documentary from the people who made Leviathan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Verena Paravel and Lucien Casting-Taylor. And their new film is called, it's a Latin title, De Humani Corporis Fabrica. And it's basically a very, very in-depth look inside a hospital, and specifically the surgical wing of the hospital. So it is, as I said, as long as people aren't suffering, I can watch anything. But if that's not if you have any kind of squeamishness about the human body being sort of taken apart, dissected, cut into, this is probably a film you would want to avoid.
Sounds like it might be good for this podcast.
It might very well. So I think those are the two that I've been most enthusiastic about. Like a lot of people, I really enjoyed the Indian film RRR.
Oh yeah, I'm so excited to see that.
Yeah, which is I'm a little embarrassed by how few Indian films I see. This is one of the only ones in the last 20 years that's gotten so much buzz that I felt like I should check it out. But I feel like there's probably some other equally, or if not equally, at least pretty good stuff that I'm overlooking by just not knowing. I just don't know who I should be turning to. I should be more proactive in trying to find out who are the good critics who are tackling this stuff and where they are.
All right, yeah. Well, I'm definitely looking forward to all of those. I loved Leviathan and Decision to Leave. I'm particularly excited to see now.
Yeah.
But we're at that weird kind of point in the year where I think we're about to get hit with the flurry of the real, high-profile titles. So who knows what that list will look like by the end, I guess.
This is normally when I would be seeing them, because normally I would be at Toronto right now. Because the Toronto Film Festival is ongoing as we're recording this. The only reason I'm not there is because I still... unlike a lot of my peers, apparently, I still don't feel comfortable. It's not so much at this point, I'm fully vaccinated and boosted and all of that. It's not that I'm worried that I'm going to get COVID and die anymore. It's that it's a lot of money, and I would hate to spend all of that money and then test positive on day three with a really mild case, but still feel obligated to spend the rest of the festival quarantined in my hotel room, not seeing any movies.
Yes.
So I was just like, I don't feel like the case loads have dwindled to the point where I'm willing to roll the dice on that quite yet. Maybe next year. Hopefully next year. I thought I was going to be back this year. But I still ultimately, when the time came when I had to buy the plane ticket, I looked at the cases and I was just like, I'm not ready yet. So
yeah, that's too bad they're not doing them virtually in a more consistent manner after pulling that off when COVID first came out.
I figured, yeah.
I wrote a whole piece for the AV Club, I think. Yeah, it must have been. About a year and a half ago, maybe. But basically arguing, we should continue this, continue to allow people to attend festivals virtually. It will only help your...
Absolutely.
It will be a 100% a positive thing and in no way negative if you do this. But people have not been taking me at my word so far. So.
I just figured that shit was happening. That's wild.
Yeah. There is a very small virtual Toronto happening, but you have to be in Canada, which I can get around that. I mean, anyone can if they really want to with a VPN, but the number of films that are available that way is extremely small. It's only 20 films out of 200, and the only one that I was interested in was the Herzog film, so it didn't seem like it was going to be worth the cost of the pass or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, but anyway, point is, I'm not going to get to see most of these exciting new films until later in the year like everyone else.
Yeah, you can finally feel the frustration we do every year reading about these for months and months before we can see them.
I do, and I still get press screenings. I was at Triangle of Sadness, the Palme d'Or winner, literally this morning, so I shouldn't be complaining.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Well, fingers crossed for next year, for sure.
Yeah, get Mike over there.
Please.
And destroy COVID. I order cans to destroy COVID.
So, again, I encourage everyone to check out Mike's Patreon. Like he said, just for $1, you get it all. Is there anything else out there to plug?
I think you mentioned that I'm also writing reviews professionally for the site Alternate Ending, which was that was a weird little thing where I just kind of stumbled onto them, and their regular critic for I think the entirety of the site's existence is a guy named Tim Brayton. I had never really heard of him before, but I started reading his reviews and thought he was fantastic. So I subscribed to their Patreon, and by doing that, the site manager, not Tim, but another guy, ended up contacting me and asking if I wanted to write for them. And I did. So now I'm writing for them as well. And getting some, because my reviews for the Patreon, because I'm writing every single day, usually, or most days, those tend to be maybe 300 to 500 words. I'm writing like full on like 1200 word reviews for Alternate Endings. So that's where to go to look for my stuff that's in more depth. Although often it will be about shittier movies.
Right.
Because Tim tends to cherry pick the really good ones. But so yeah, that's pretty much where I am these days.
We will link to that in the episode description if you want to read Mike's writing about shittier movies.
Yeah, shitty movies.
I try to have fun no matter how bad the movie is. Hopefully the writing will still be enjoyable.
That's the goal.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it really means a lot that you were on with us for this. It was not a movie we wanted to go into lightly. It was good to have it be a big conversation with you.
Yeah, I was happy to do it.
Someone who was there, the eye of the storm when it happened.
Oh, that truly is one of the most unforgettable theatrical experiences of my life. Not my number one, but certainly in the top like 10 or thereabouts.
Mike was right there in the rectum while this was all happening.
Number one was Brown Bunny, right?
No, I actually, I wasn't at the actual premiere of Brown Bunny. I forget. I think I couldn't get in because word had gotten out that there was a Chloe Savigny blowjob scene in it that was unsimulated. So, and I didn't have a good enough badge to get. So I ended up seeing the later
blowjob badge.
Yeah. I ended up seeing a later screening of that. No, the most amazing theatrical experience I have ever had in my life that I wish I could show people what it was like was either opening day or opening weekend. I'm not sure which of Malcolm X, which I saw in a Times Square theater in which I was one of maybe three white people in the entire theater that was sold out. And it was unbelievable. Like I have never encountered an audience reaction like that in my life. It was astonishing.
Holy shit.
Yeah. It was, it was electrifying.
Oh, that's great.
I believe you.
The film itself is great, but to see it with that particular group of like really hyped up people who were there for it was like nothing else I've ever experienced. Actually, I take that back, and this will sound ridiculous, but the one occasion that was similar was the opening night of U2 Rattle and Hum with a bunch of very rabid U2 fans in 1988.
I can only imagine everybody crying audibly.
But
I imagine there were more than three white people in that audience.
Yeah, many, many more than three.
Oh, my mom would have killed to be in that room.
All right. Well, I'm glad we had a lighter note to end on then. So some nice, happy theatrical experiences.
But of course, you should begin with that note in order to get it in the reverse order and move back toward chaos.
I'm so glad this episode's going to open with us talking about Rattle and Hum.
Absolutely.
All right. Yeah, this will be Tony's finest work yet.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to it.
I'm going
to
release the straight cut on the Patreon. So if you want to hear this conversation in an intelligible way, you gotta subscribe.
Unwind. Watchables is produced by Tony Scarpitti, hosted by me, Mark D'Ottavio, and Seth Troyer, with artwork by Micah Krause. You can find Seth and I on Letterboxd under Mark D'Ottavio and Sloth Troyer. You can also check us out at unwatchablespod.com for links to our Twitter and Instagram, or support us on Patreon for bonus content and to have a say in what we watch. Thanks for listening.